TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fire and the Underground Life in the Forest, Peter Wohlleben and Suzanne Simard. As California tries to come to terms with the largest and deadliest fires of 2018, attention falls on forests. Logging companies want more clear cuts. Donald Trump says the forest floor should be cleaned with rakes. Indigenous elders and visionary foresters say that nobody is asking the trees what they want and need, especially now as the heat is rising, water becomes scarce, and winds are fiercer. Peter Wohlleben is the author of The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate, Discoveries from a Secret World. He's a German forester who became disenchanted by the technologies he was expected to employ, including the felling of old-growth trees and the use of insecticides. He now manages a 4,000-year-old beech tree forest in Germany. People can buy a tree as a headstone for burial. He was interviewed by Steve Piken on The Agenda in October 2016.
Are trees able to form friendships? Can forests have moods? Do trees warn each other of danger? You may think these are ridiculous questions to ask, but forester Peter Wohlleben presents a compelling scientific case for these and other surprising discoveries. It's all in his book, The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate. And Peter Wohlleben joins us now. It's great to have you here. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
What made you even think to consider studying this issue?
In the first, years, I was a normal forester, and I know about tree feelings as much as a butcher about animal feelings. Mm-hmm. And that's also, knowing too much about it, it's bad for the business. But in my forest district, we created a burial forest, a forest where people may be buried in urns. I did it to rescue this old forest. It's a 4,000-year-old beech tree forest. And the people can buy their trees as a living headstone. Hmm. And and then together with those people, my view became a better one, not just as a forester, but I saw trees once again as wonderful beings and not just as raw materials for the next sawmill. And together with those people, I discovered new things in the forest. And then I discovered that, for example, that a very old at first, it looks to me like a stone, a moss-covered stone, and it turns out to be the remnant of an old tree stump. The tree has been felled 400 or 500 years ago, and this old stump is still living. And the question is, how can that be? It burns sugar in its cells, like we do, without any green leaf. So where came the nutrition from where? And the only explanation is that the surrounding neighbor trees supporting this old fellow to keep it alive.
I want to read an excerpt from your book here. Yeah. So here we go. A pair of true friends is careful right from the outset not to grow overly thick branches in each other's direction. The trees don't want to take anything away from each other. And so they develop sturdy branches only at the outer edges of their crowns. That is to say, only in the direction of non-friends. Such partners are often so tightly connected at the roots that sometimes they even die together. How do you think trees develop these, as you call them, friendships?
Trees are able to detect which sort of tree is standing beside. For example, a mother tree is able to detect its own child, its own seedlings. In the root tips, there are brain-like structures. University of Bonn is doing research on this. That sounds esoteric, like Lord of the Rings, like the Ents or so, but that's reality, that's a fact. They have brain-like structures and there are brain-like processes going on. And with those root tips, they are able to see, that's my relative, a family member, that are my children, or that is a tree which may become a friend. That happens not very often, perhaps in one of 50 cases, because you're not able to move as a tree. And when the tree next to you is not nice to you, then it won't be a friend. And for the rest of your lifetime, you are a lonely tree. But sometimes it's matches, and then those trees combine their root system and, yeah, work together as being a whole a single tree.
When you are walking through a forest, can you just tell with the naked eye, these two are friends?
Yeah.
You can tell?
Yeah, and hopefully the readers are afterwards also able to do. Because it's really easy to detect it. You just have to watch above you in the crowns, and then you see trees which are working together, bringing the branches just in the outside. And trees which are no friends, they shrink their thick branches, they struggle a little bit for light, and real friends don't do that. They don't disturb each other. Yeah, and you can see that on your own, and perhaps all readers.
Are some trees more social than other trees?
Really, yeah. You can see that the best when you're watching old stumps. They are not not all old stumps are supported in the way I described it. There are some stumps which rot away very fast and go back to earth like humus. And those stumps, yeah, you can say they are lone wolves, which like we have it in a human society. There are always people who want to have to do nothing with other people, and these things you can also find among trees.
But can you tell, for example, that a maple tree is more friendly than a cedar tree or a pine tree than a birch tree?
Yeah, yeah, you can say that. That depends on the species. For example, a birch tree likes to live on its own. And when there's a neighboring tree stands beside it, the birch tree has hanging branches which are working like wipes. And when the wind is going through, it wipes the branches from the neighbor tree away. We have such a pair, the Douglas fir and a birch in my garden. And the birch wiped out the branches from the Douglas fir in the shape of the birch crown. Hmm. So, birch is a little aggressive.
Is that because it's a hardwood, or that has nothing to do with
it? No, it has nothing to do with it. Birch trees are used to live on their own because they are the first ones to settle on new land. And there, on new land, there is no forest, and you have to compete, you have to be fast. And so, because they are exhausted within 100 years, after 100 years, and that's a short period, a short time for a tree, mm-hmm. then they will die. And so they are not so social like Douglas fir or beech trees or maple or whatsoever.
Since trees are alive, obviously, and since, as you've told us, through ultrasonic waves, they scream in a certain way, do you know whether they feel pain when they get chopped down?
Yeah, really. I think they feel pain. When we chop a tree, then we think the tree is dead. But what is the tree? For example, is a trunk? Perhaps it's nothing else than a big trunk, big metal thing, with solar cells on it, and the real tree is in the soil. Hmm. We don't know it. We don't know where a tree stores its memories. And when I told you that a tree has in its root tips brain-like structures, perhaps that's the main thing on trees. And when you chop down a tree, you just chop down its solar cells. And the bigger part of the tree, the most important part of the tree, is still there. And that's perhaps the reason why it is supported by the neighbor trees. Hmm.
I know what the World Wide Web is. What is the Wood Wide Web?
The Wood Wide Web is the combination of root and fungi network in the forest. Fungi network, fungi are not able to feed themselves like plants. So scientists don't know whether they are animals or plants. And so they say the whole world is on animals, plants, and fungi. So the fungi are growing in the soil. In one teaspoon full of earth, you have several miles of fungi filaments. And the fungi are connecting the trees and transporting, for example, news from one tree to another. And therefore, they get sugar solution. They are getting paid for it. And they are very expensive because a tree has to pay as much as one-third of the whole photosynthesis production. That's as much as a tree stores in form of timber. So it's a very expensive wood wide web, but it works.
How far can those messages go?
We don't know. Fungi can become very big, several square miles in size, and the research is still on its way. How far it goes, what news are transported, and that are not just news, and also sugar solution, because the trees are not just supporting themselves via a root network, but also on this fungi network. And the fungi is not always working proper. It's It has its own strategy. For example, when it should transport sugar from one beech tree to another, sometimes it's getting some sugar to other tree species because perhaps one time, one day, the beech trees will die. And then the fungi will die too because it relies on trees. And when there's another species living in this forest, the fungi may survive, and therefore they're supporting, although they are not supposed to do so, other species.
Why do you think it's important for us to know what trees are saying?
That's important for two things. Because when we, on one hand, it's better to know that because we can manage forests in a better way. Healthy forests produce more and better timber and produce more oxygen and are more stable in storms and fire and so on. But on the other hand, it's more fun for us. We may enjoy it. For example, when you look at an elephant, you don't ask what benefits give it to us. We just say, oh, what a wonderful being. Mm. And when you look on a plant elephant, and trees are plant elephants, the biggest plants that we have, and you know all those wonderful things, I think you will have a lot of fun when you walk through the forest.
A lot of fun, but do you want us to change the way we deal with trees?
Yeah, that would be a great thing. I think when people begin to love trees and look at them like on elephants, then they won't waste paper for things which are not worthful. They perhaps will reduce a little consumption. And when they buy things based on timber, then perhaps from better managed forests.
Let's do one more quote before we leave today. It is okay to use wood as long as the trees are allowed to live in a way that is appropriate to their species. And that means that they should be allowed to fulfill their social needs, to grow in a true forest environment on undisturbed ground, and to pass their knowledge on to the next generation. And at least some of them should be allowed to grow old with dignity and finally die a natural death. It does make me wonder whether you're at all guilty for the trees that had to die to make this book. What do you think?
And that's I'm also heating with firewood. I'm a human being. I'm not able to make photosynthesis. And for example, when you eat breakfast, you need farmland, and there once stood a primeval forest. So the question is, what are our rights? What are the rights of the trees? And I think we have to get it in a better balance. And then it's okay to use wood. Wood is a really great stuff to make a table out of timber or to heat with wood. But I think we should leave some land, some preserves for trees so that they are able to live in family bands and so that we have fun to watch them how they live.
Ausgezeichnet. Dankeschön, Peter. That was fabulous. Peter Wohlleben, The Hidden Life of Trees. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Peter Wohlleben interviewed by Steve Paikin on The Agenda in October 2016. Wohlleben referred to research by colleagues and scientists that he benefited from. Important among them is Suzanne Simard, professor of forest ecology. She teaches at the University of British Columbia. She has tested theories about how trees communicate with other trees. She used radioactive carbon to measure the flow and sharing of carbon between individual trees and species. Simard also helped identify something called a hub tree, or mother tree. They are the largest trees in forests that act as central hubs for vast below-ground mycorrhizal networks. Here's a short clip from a documentary by Dan McKinney, followed by quotes from her frequent presentations on TED Talks.
I'm a forester, specialized into looking at below-ground communities. We found that these fungi actually will connect one plant to another plant. This tree here has got roots growing out everywhere. And as we get further away from the tree, we're more likely to find its roots, the ones that are involved in this trade. This is where the fungi hunt or scavenge for nutrients. So the tree sends down its carbon, it goes through the root system and through into these fungi. And there's an interface between the root cortical cells and the fungal cell that's wrapped itself around that cortical cell, and that's where this exchange goes on. The mother trees we think of as the big old trees. They catch your eye when you walk into a forest. This Douglas fir is about 500 years old. It's a massive tree that will have an enormous network associated with it. So you could think of this as a mother tree. You know, it's in the sense that it's a dominant tree in the forest. It's probably networked into all of the trees all around it, even though they're of different species. So this tree is probably linked over to trees as far as you can see. It's just that there are trees in between that are the bridges for the network. Forest ecosystems are really complex systems, just like the Earth is a complex system, the biosphere. And the way it works is that we have all these parts, and all these parts are working together, like the fungus is working together with the tree. It's a lot like how our brains work. In neural networks, our brains are comprised of neurons and axons, and these neurons are physically related, but they're also, you know, almost metaphysically related, because they're sending messages back and forth and they're building upon each other. It works a lot like a forest ecosystem, and that diversity is really what gives the forest resilience. The resilience to withstand unexpected events like a fire that might come through, or an insect, or a windstorm. Well, somebody's going to be left standing because there's a diversity there. Some of the forest practices that we have done pay no attention to the role of these mother trees, or that trees actually will move some of their legacy to the new generation. We didn't pay attention to it. Instead, what we did is we went and cut down those trees after they died so that we could make 2x4s out of them. And we didn't give them a chance to give back to the community, I don't think. So what those dying trees will do is that they will also move resources into living trees, to the young ones coming up before they go, before they completely collapse. It's a transfer, like a passing of the wand from one generation to the next, if we allow it to happen.
Imagine you're walking through a forest. I'm guessing you're thinking of a collection of trees, what we foresters call a stand, with their rugged stems and their beautiful crowns. Yes, trees are the foundation of forests, but a forest is much more than what you see. And today, I want to change the way you think about forests. You see, underground, there is this other world, a world of infinite biological pathways that connect trees and allow them to communicate, and allow the forest to behave as though it's a single organism. It might remind you of a sort of intelligence. How do I know this? Here's my story. I grew up in the forests of British Columbia. I used to lie on the forest floor and stare up at the tree crowns. They were giants. My grandfather was a giant too. He was a horse logger, and he used to selectively cut cedar poles from the inland rainforests. Grandpa taught me about the quiet and cohesive ways of the woods, and how my family was knit into it. So I followed in Grandpa's footsteps. He and I had this curiosity about forests. So I studied forestry. But soon I found myself working alongside the powerful people in charge of the commercial harvest. The extent of the clear-cutting was alarming, and I soon found myself conflicted by my part in it. Not only that, the spraying and hacking of the aspens and birches to make way for the more commercially valuable planted pines and firs was astounding. It seemed that nothing could stop this relentless industrial machine. So I went back to school, and I studied my other world. You see, scientists had just discovered in the laboratory in vitro that one pine seedling root could transmit carbon to another pine seedling root. But this was in the laboratory, and I wondered, could this happen in real forests? I thought, yes. Trees in real forests might also share information below ground. But this was really controversial, and some people thought I was crazy. And I had a really hard time getting research funding. But I persevered, and I eventually conducted some experiments deep in the forest, 25 years ago. The evidence was clear. The C13 and C14 was showing me that Paper Birch and Douglas fir were in a lively two-way conversation. It turns out at that time of the year in the summer that birch was sending more carbon to fir than fir was sending back to birch, especially when the fir was shaded. And then in later experiments, we found the opposite, that fir was sending more carbon to birch than birch was sending to fir. And this was because the fir was still growing while the birch was leafless. So it turns out the two species were interdependent, like yin and yang. And at that moment, everything came into focus for me. I knew I'd found something big, something that would change the way we look at how trees interact in forests, from not just competitors, but to cooperators. And I had found solid evidence of this massive below-ground communications network, the other world. Now, I truly hoped and believed that my discovery would change how we practice forestry, from clear-cutting and herbiciding to more holistic and sustainable methods, methods that were less expensive and more practical. What was I thinking? I'll come back to that. Now, I want to talk about the science. How were paper birch and Douglas fir communicating? Well, it turns out they were conversing not only in the language of carbon, but also nitrogen and phosphorus and water and defense signals and allele chemicals and hormones, information. And you know, I have to tell you, before me, scientists had thought that this below-ground mutualistic symbiosis called a mycorrhiza was involved. Mycorrhiza literally means fungus root. You see their reproductive organs when you walk through the forest. They're the mushrooms. The mushrooms, though, are just the tip of the iceberg, because coming out of those stems are fungal threads that form a mycelium, and that mycelium infects and colonizes the roots of all the trees and plants. And where the fungal cells interact with the root cells, there's a trade of carbon for nutrients. And that fungus gets those nutrients by growing through the soil and coating every soil particle. The web is so dense that there can be hundreds of kilometers of mycelium under a single footstep. And not only that, that mycelium connects different individuals in the forest. Individuals not only of the same species, but between species, like birch and fir. And it works kind of like the internet. You see, like all networks, mycorrhizal networks have nodes and links. In a single forest, a mother tree can be connected to hundreds of other trees. And using our isotope tracers, we have found that mother trees will send their excess carbon through the mycorrhizal network to the understory seedlings. And we've associated this with increased seedling survival by 4 times. Now, we know we all favor our own children. And I wondered, could Douglas fir recognize its own kin? Like Mama Grizzly and her cub? So we set about an experiment, and we grew mother trees with kin and stranger seedlings. And it turns out they do recognize their kin. Mother trees colonize their kin with bigger mycorrhizal networks. They send them more carbon below ground. They even reduce their own root competition to make elbow room for their kids. When mother trees are injured or dying, they also send messages, wisdom, onto the next generation of seedlings. So we've used isotope tracing to trace carbon moving from an injured mother tree down her trunk into the mycorrhizal network and into her neighboring seedlings. Not only carbon, but also defense signals. And these two compounds have increased the resistance of those seedlings to future stresses. So trees talk. Thank you. So let's come back to the initial point. Forests aren't simply collections of trees. They're complex systems with hubs and networks that overlap and connect trees and allow them to communicate. And they provide avenues for feedbacks and adaptation. And this makes the forest resilient. That's because there are many hub trees and many overlapping networks. But they're also vulnerable. Vulnerable not only to natural disturbances, like bark beetles that preferentially attack big old trees, but high-grade logging and clear-cut logging. You see, you can take out one or two hub trees, but there comes a tipping point. Because hub trees are not unlike rivets in an airplane. You can take out one or two, and the plane still flies. But you take out one too many, or maybe that one holding on the wings, and the whole system collapses. These simplified forests lack complexity, and they're really vulnerable to infections and bugs. And as climate changes, this is creating a perfect storm. For extreme events, like the massive mountain pine beetle outbreak that just swept across North America, or that mega fire in the last couple of months in Alberta. So I want to come back to my final question. Instead of weakening our forests, how can we reinforce them and help them deal with climate change? Well, you know, the great thing about forests as complex systems is they have enormous capacity to self-heal. In our recent experiments, we found with patch cutting and retention of hub trees and regeneration to a diversity of species and genes and genotypes, that these mycorrhizal networks, they recover really rapidly. So with this in mind, I want to leave you with four simple solutions. And we can't kid ourselves that these are too complicated to act on. First, we all need to get out in the forest. We need to reestablish local involvement in our own forests. You see, most of our forests now are managed using a one-size-fits-all approach. But good forest stewardship requires knowledge of local conditions. Second, we need to save our old-growth forests. These are the repositories of genes and mother trees and mycorrhizal networks. So this means less cutting. I don't mean no cutting, but less cutting. And third, when we do cut, we need to save the legacies, the mother trees and networks, and the wood, the genes, so they can pass their wisdom onto the next generation of trees, so they can withstand the future stresses coming down the road. We need to be conservationists. And finally, fourthly and finally, we need to regenerate our forests with a diversity of species and genotypes and structures by planting and allowing natural regeneration. We have to give Mother Nature the tools she needs to use her intelligence to self-heal. And we need to remember that forests aren't just a bunch of trees competing with each other, they're super cooperators. I hope today to have changed how you think about forests. Thank you.
That was Suzanne Simard, a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. Before her, you heard from the forester Peter Wohlleben. Both have been seen on YouTube and TED Talks. You heard Fire and the Underground Life in the Forest. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio's free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. My name is Maria Gleuden. Thank you for listening.